Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, July 6, 2015. Yesterday, Greek voters went to the polls and said, hell no, to an expired bailout deal that meant more austerity.
No means no, not anything goes. You went with it.
62% of Greeks said no to continuing bailout discussions. That would mean cuts to pensions, to government spending, and a sentence of perhaps death for the economy of Greece. And this, of course, leads to more unknown, more destabilizing potential. But the Greek voters spoke loudly and clearly and support the government of Alexis Tsipras, which was elected essentially to renegotiate these bad deals that are suffocating the economy of Greece. So it's anybody's guess exactly what will happen next. Tsipras made an interesting political move and sacked his finance minister, the controversial Yanis Varoufakis. Varoufakis had said that he would cut off his arm, or that he'd rather cut off his arm than go back to accepting the awful deal offered by the European bankers. His arm is still there, but he did resign, even though the vote favored the Tsipras administration. And apparently this is a way to try to smooth over the ruffled feathers among the European leaders and European bankers. The new finance minister is Oxford-educated Euclid Sakalotis, who took over from Varoufakis as the lead negotiator at the end of April. So the Greek banks are about out of cash. The cash machines, the ATMs, are running dry. And the European Central Bank has maintained the emergency loans to create some liquidity in the Greek banking system. But they're saying they're going to tighten those requirements and ask for more collateral. Well, I don't know what the Greeks can offer as collateral, because as part of the deal with the International Monetary Fund, they had to sell off a lot of public assets, airports and public facilities. And so the bankers may be strapped, looking for, what, family jewels and loans on automobiles. I don't know what kind of collateral they will be able to put forward. But the picture is clearly very difficult, and it's unpredictable. And meanwhile, Angela Merkel is being the tough mother. She is, of course, the Chancellor of Germany. And the only hopeful note is that she is dining this evening in Paris with its leader, France's leader, François Hollande. And France has indicated a little more lenient view toward the Greek position. So we'll be watching, and it'll be, a very, very pins and needles kind of week for the people of Greece. And I think here is an interesting analysis published as an op-ed in The Guardian today, written by Larry Elliott, and he's a columnist there. I don't know too much more about him. He said, there are now only three outcomes from the crisis. Greece stays in the euro on a slightly more advantageous terms than were on offer last week. Greece and the Troika, the bankers, stitch up a short-term funding deal in the hope that a lasting solution can be found later. Or the creditors reject the olive branch held out by Tsipras, who, by the way, has said he wants to stay in the euro and that he simply wants to renegotiate the draconian terms. In any event, he will be able to say he did everything in his power to avoid a return to the old Greek currency, the drachma, but was left no choice due to the intransigence of the banking community. And I will add that it's interesting the international sympathy that is developing. I think a lot of people, including many Americans, understand that this is not just a deadbeat nation. That France and other countries in the Eurozone extended loans to Greece in order to sell them arms that clearly the nation doesn't need. We know about how Goldman Sachs gamed the pension funds of Greece. And so when the collapse hit in 2008, they decided to make an example of Greece to brush back other countries that were teetering, like Portugal and Spain. And that was ages ago, but the positions have hardened and stay in place. And the now somewhat famous French economist Thomas Piketty has said, well, look, Germany never paid back all of its debts from the era of the Nazis. And in fact, in a very prominent move, and I think it was in 1947 or so, the government of Greece forgave 50% of monies owed to it by the nation of Germany. Is it time for a little turnabout and fair play? I might say so. Well, I'm inclined to make a mockery of this by telling you that we're all reeling from the wave of Islamic State terrorist attacks inside our homeland over the 4th of July weekend. But I'll resist that urge. I'm just infuriated that the corporate media dutifully and stenographically reported these hysterical warnings that came from a former CIA official, Mike Morrell, and from leaks from the FBI over the past week or 10 days. We were warned that the 4th of July was going to be this event where lone wolves or cells that have been activated by Islamic State communications would begin some sort of deadly operations. Nothing of the sort occurred. The major outcome is 7,000 cops in New York got hefty overtime. And I'll remind you that it was 10 years ago on the 4th of July that a woman named Julia Davis, who was working for the Border Patrol at the San Diego-Mexico crossing, tried to signal that she was very concerned because she saw a wave of Arabs coming through that checkpoint with Mexico. And when she notified her superiors, they were all out on holiday. And so she decided to do what she had been instructed, and she reported this to the FBI. Now, there were no terrorist events that resulted, but for her very careful scrutiny of the situation before her and for following instructions, she got several years of retaliation. She told us her story. If you've never heard it, go to the Peter B. Collins website and just put Julia Davis into the search window. It's an astounding story. I mean, involving black helicopters and armed shock troops that descended on a home that she and her husband own out in the desert area of southeastern California. It's just amazing. Now, speaking of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, they have notched another victory here in California as disgraced former State Senator Leland Yee of San Francisco took a guilty plea last week. He said that he had conducted the affairs of a campaign through a pattern of racketeering activity. Now, it is fair to say that the FBI, setting up a sting operation, having undercover agents who posed as members of a mob gang from New Jersey in one case, it's fair to say that Leland Yee took their cash. He proved that he is corruptible. And I don't have any affinity for Leland Yee. He's a guy I've known talked to a few times. I didn't have any great respect for him. He seemed like a self-interested political operator, and that's about all. But it's pretty clear to me that he was entrapped, that they set up this operation, and they discovered that he had a need for cash. It's not clear whether he actually converted money that should have gone into a campaign to personal use. But he did accept a $6,800 bribe in exchange for one of these silly resolutions with a certificate that he got passed by the state senate for whoever gave him the $6,800. Now, that resolution honored a group from Chinatown called Gi Kung Tong. And one of the people linked to that group is a guy who has not accepted a plea deal and is likely to go to trial in a year or two. And his name is Shrimp Boy, Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. And one of the reasons I'm pretty confident that Shrimp Boy will go to trial is that I know his defense attorney, the infamous Tony Serra. And Tony Serra loves to take on the government and expose their wrongdoing. Now, one of the curiosities of Leland Yee's plea deal, he took a plea along with three other co-defendants, including a former political consultant who was a party to some of these cash exchanges. None of these four people is required to testify at Shrimp Boy's upcoming trial. That is highly unusual, because one of the basic reasons for a plea deal is in order to get testimony against other parties to a conspiracy. So this indicates to me that the FBI doesn't want the four principals to testify because it might provide evidence of the entrapment that I am alleging that could cause all of the convictions to be thrown out. And this is just another snapshot of the way our federal government law enforcement agencies are working post 9/11. Leland Yee didn't have a prayer of challenging these issues as entrapment. And the FBI is busy doing this on a daily basis, as we have reported repeatedly here at this podcast. Here's the latest. It's a group of environmental activists here in the West, some of them based in Colorado. And the article in The Guardian focuses on a woman named Deanna Meyer, who is a member of a group called Deep Green Resistance. And by all accounts, Deep Green Resistance is sympathetic with individuals who take direct action, but its members eschew violence and are not involved in any direct action. And so over the last couple of years, the FBI and agents from Homeland Security have been following these environmental activists. And now their lawyer, a guy named Larry Hildes, seems to have been swept up into the investigation. He has been detained at border crossings on numerous occasions in recent months. He lives near the Canadian border, and he crosses frequently. So the activists have recounted a mix of FBI visits, going back to last October, as agents showed up at their workplaces, their homes, contacted family members, in one case trying to flip one of the members into becoming an informant. And they also asked questions about whether these people were opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. Now, the latest move by Deanna Meyer is a campaign in Boulder to relocate a prairie dog colony that is threatened by the site of a new shopping mall. Now, from every indication, I have to believe that these people are focused on First Amendment protected activities. I haven't seen anything to the contrary. But this pattern of behavior occurred after the FBI was embarrassed and had to close an investigation into anti-Keystone activists in Texas. They said, oh, that was a mistake. It hadn't been approved by FBI Central, blah, blah, blah. Well, Hildes, the lawyer, has been representing activists for more than 20 years, and he said that he has never been detained and questioned about one of his clients until recently. So he describes different events where he's been stopped at the border, the effort to flip one of the members to become an FBI informant, and this is consistent with what we have seen since what I call the vertical integration of law enforcement, where we have federal authorities and federal tools and the Patriot Act that gives expansive powers to FBI agents. And they spy on people, presuming that they have violent intentions, and we often see no evidence of anything of the kind. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Just like clockwork, on the first of the month, Paul Elsesser mailed out a check. Thank you, Paul. Bob Donjakour, Andy Krieger, Bill Goodacre, they're all monthly subscribers here at the PBC Podcast, and I'd like you to join them. Just for your information, I had no new subscriber signups over the lengthy 4th of July holiday. Maybe you can help make up for that. Come on board today. Log into peterbcollins.com, click the link under my picture that says sign up. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual, And new annual subscribers here or anywhere, wherever you happen to be, I'm going to email you my gift. It's an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Well, now San Francisco is embroiled in the madness of Donald Trump's racist commentary as he attempts to use it to run for president. And unfortunately, it's paying off because he's showing up in the polls. Now, we saw the serial champions of the Republican primary in 2012, where almost weekly there was a new leader in the polls. So I don't take this as a serious issue or a serious challenge on the part of Trump. He will flame out and self-destruct at some point. But he has seized on, in an effort to justify his racist comments about Mexicans, on a case that occurred here in San Francisco. Last Wednesday night, there was the shooting death of a 32-year-old woman on a pier right on San Francisco Bay along San Francisco's beautiful waterfront. And the suspect is a 45-year-old named Francisco Sanchez. It turns out that Sanchez has been deported five times before. He has a rap sheet here in U.S. courts with seven felony convictions in the past, mostly for drug offenses. And he gave a jailhouse interview to a local TV station in which he says, and this is unproven, this is his testimony, that he was just hanging out along the waterfront on a warm evening and he found a gun wrapped up in a T-shirt. So he picked up the gun and he said he was shooting at sea lions in the bay, that he fired three shots, and then he came to the ghastly realization that one of them had killed this woman who was strolling with her father out on the pier to get a look at the bay. Now, I can't prove his commentary there, but it does seem to be a bizarre, tragic, I can't quite call it an accident, but if he is to be believed, it wasn't really intentional. Now comes to the finger-pointing and the blame game and the racial, racist whistleblowing. As Donald Trump hops on Twitter and says, this senseless and totally, I guess this is a statement, this isn't a tweet, sorry. This senseless and totally preventable act of violence committed by an illegal immigrant is yet another example of why we must secure our border immediately. This is an absolutely disgraceful situation, and I am the only one who can fix it. Nobody else has the guts to even talk about it. Well, let's zoom out here for a second. Donald Trump says that if he's elected president, he will build a wall along our southern border, and he creates the myth that such a wall would keep an individual like Francisco Sanchez from re-entering the United States. But that's a myth based on the racist notion that the vast majority of our illegal immigrants come over the Mexican border, when the truth is that most of our illegal immigrants are people who overstay a visa. They entered the United States at an airport, not by swimming the Rio Grande. And so, while I don't know much about the history of this man Sanchez, I do know that the central focus will be on San Francisco's policy where we call ourselves a sanctuary city. And that is that individuals arrested for minor crimes are not immediately handed over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement for deportation. There are a lot of good reasons for the sanctuary policy, but those will be lost in the hateful exchanges, the fear-mongering about dangerous predators, rapists, and murderers who are coming over the Mexican border. And there are many people who are prepared to believe the ravings of Donald Trump over any facts that you can put in front of them. And so we are now going to enter a cycle of more irrational debate, that's in air quotes, about immigration. And as a sidebar to the shooting on the pier, the following day, Thursday morning at 6 a.m., there were two TV crews who were out there. And you know how they do this. They go to a scene where there was a crime, There's no real reason to be there because there's nothing going on. There aren't even any cops or even any police crime scene tape. I mean, it's over. But TV news loves to go live to a location where there is no news so they can have a reporter introduce a videotape package. You know how that goes, right? So, 6 a.m. Thursday morning, crews from the NBC affiliate and from the Fox-owned KTVU were out on the pier doing live reports when three robbers, some packing at least one pistol, showed up and tried to rob these camera crews of their cameras and equipment. One of the camera operators was pistol-whipped by one of the three assailants. That camera operator said, "Hey, just take the camera." And he said, "I thought I was he was going to kill the other cameraman from the other TV station." And there is footage of this attempt to go from the studio to the live scene. And a reporter there said, "I can't do the report right now. There's something going on here." I think it's unusual in a number of ways. First of all, the robbers are pretty stupid to attack a crew when cameras are rolling, feeding live television. Now, I don't think that pictures have actually captured these guys, and they appear to still be at large. But just as a fundamental rule of crime 101, it's not a good idea to try to rip off TV reporters and camera crews while they're working, because they may create evidence of your crime, moron. Then, of course, my other criticism is that these TV stations go to these scenes for simply no reason. It's just a routine that they have developed. In other news, I'm disappointed to report that two American Christian church denominations have dealt a setback to the pro-Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The Episcopal Church, with 1.8 million members, has defeated a resolution. It appears that the representatives of the membership approved it in a kind of convocation, but that the House of Bishops rejected that resolution. And separately, the Mennonite Church USA meeting in Kansas City decided to postpone a vote on a similar resolution until its next convention in 2017. Well, today I'm releasing an in-depth interview with my friend Colonel Ann Wright, member of Code Pink for Peace, an activist for peace on many fronts, and most recently a member of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. It is Ann Wright's third trip trying to enter Gaza, and as you know, the boats were turned away, one of them intercepted by the Israeli Navy and taken into custody in the port of Ashdod. The other three boats peeled off before confronting the Israeli Navy. And so Ann Wright has returned stateside, and she gave us an extensive first-person account in our in-depth interview. And she had this to say about the BDS movement: boycott, divestment, and sanction.
The fact that it's taking billions of dollars, that people like Sheldon Adelson are the ones that are stepping up with almost unlimited deep pockets of money to throw money at this problem, to buy off university presidents and board of directors, tempting them with hundreds of millions of dollars in potential grants and endowments shows how effective BDS is. You know, just a week and a half ago, the United Church of Christ organization adopted a BDS resolution where they will divest from any companies that are doing business of the state of Israel. So that's a major thing. The Methodist Church has done that. So finally, we're getting some of the religious groups of the United States to step up to acknowledge what's been going on, that the apartheid Israel and its brutality toward the Palestinians must be addressed, and religious groups have to be a part of this whole thing, as they were during the anti-apartheid work on South Africa back in the 80s.
You can hear the full interview with Ann Wright. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you find our podcasts. David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, is floating a proposal that Britain may expand its military action against the Islamic State. In particular, it had said it would only operate in Iraq, and now he is essentially floating the trial balloon that Britain will join the U.S. in bombing the Islamic State in Syria. What I have a real problem with here is that the pretext, the triggering event, is that Cameron is saying that due to the deaths of 30 British tourists who were killed by gunmen in Tunisia a week or so ago, that the British response is to attack the Islamic State in Syria. And I have a big problem because here, buried in the New York Times story, it reads, the killings of more than three dozen tourists were committed by a guy named, it's a tough name, Saifedin Rezgui, age 24, and it says, a student who was reported to have links with the Islamic State. Now, once again, I warn you about this very slippery slope. Because individuals who were inspired by the Islamic State, this guy apparently went to Libya and got some training. But the people in Libya who pledge allegiance to the Islamic State are not the same as the Islamic State fighters in Syria and Iraq. They are projecting this expansive reach, an almost global reach, that led to the kind of hysteria I was talking about from the CIA and the FBI about potential attacks here in the United States. And so for Britain to say that it's going to respond to the attacks in Tunisia that are linked to the Islamic State, not caused by them, is just a part of this pattern of behavior that I am highly skeptical about. Back in the U.S. in Arizona, 2 days of rioting has left portions of an Arizona prison operated by a corporation uninhabitable, forcing the state to shift over 700 inmates to other facilities. Two of the five housing units at the Arizona State Prison in Kingman were damaged by separate violent incidents on consecutive days. The first was on July 1st. A major disturbance took place in a minimum security section of the prison, and the following night a second riot broke out. Now, there's a pattern here that this private prison, which is operated by MTC, Management and Training Corporation, well, it opened in 2004. Three prisoners escaped in 2010. One went on a crime spree that left an Oklahoma couple dead. Just last month, the family of a 23-year-old former prisoner who died in January filed suit seeking $7.5 million in damages for negligence. And private prisons are a real problem because their motivation is to make money and to keep a lid on any complaints or any issues that may arise. And while I do not in any way defend rioting, we have to ask what caused the inmates, particularly those in a minimum security section, to riot. Well, we'll leave it up to the lamestream media in the great state of Arizona, and perhaps someday we'll find out what triggered these riots. Last week, the Justice Department announced that it's going to investigate price fixing by the airlines based in the United States. Now, you may know that we basically have the Big Four. American, Delta, Southwest, and United now control more than 80% of the seats in the domestic travel market. As a result, the allegation is that they have colluded to reduce capacity in order to drive up the revenue that they can derive from each seat on a flight. They've also cut back on all kinds of service to smaller communities in order to cut their costs. And it's working. The average domestic airfare was up 13% by 2014 as compared with 2009, and that doesn't include the billions that they collect for baggage fees and for changing domestic reservations. In the last 12 months, the airlines took in $3.6 billion in bag fees and another $3 billion in reservation change fees. Now, I'm old enough to remember when we had regulated airline service in this country. The airlines were all profitable. The fares were relatively low. We didn't pay these baggage fees or extortion to change a flight. And the industry scored almost $20 billion in profits in the last 2 years alone. So I hope that the Justice Department will look hard, and if they find the collusion I suspect, I hope they will hit them hard and give us all a free trip to anywhere we want to go. Wouldn't that be nice? And finally today, the state of California has announced new rules governing fracking. They are claimed to be some of the toughest guidelines in the nation. Lawmakers approved these 2 years ago. They kicked in on July 1st. It requires oil companies to expand monitoring and reporting of water use and water quality, conduct broad analysis, potential engineering and seismic impacts of their operations, and comprehensively disclose chemicals used during fracking and other operations. Now, I'll credit State Senator Fran Pavley, who authored the bill and shepherded it through the legislature despite great opposition from oil interests and disinterest from Governor Jerry Brown, who has failed to rein in fracking in any way. Now, the new rules sound nice. The problem is we have a state agency with the unfortunate acronym name DOGGER, Department of Geological blah, blah, blah. Anyway, DOGGER is a lame agency, and we know that. And will they actually enforce these rules on a rogue industry? I tend to doubt it. Now, one of the interesting elements here is that along with the release of these new rules, DOGGER issued its latest environmental impact report. The three-volume report concluded that fracking could, in a worst-case scenario, generate greenhouse gas emissions that may have a significant impact on the environment. They could also increase pollutants to levels that violate an air quality standard or contribute substantially to an existing or projected air quality violation. But, again, the bottom line is here, will DOGGER have the claws and the teeth to really herd the industry in a better direction? And at this point, I'd have to guess that the answer is not so much. Thanks a lot for joining me today for the News and Comment podcast. This podcast is absolutely free, and you are free to share it with anybody. I hope you'll get started. Why don't you post it on Facebook and like it? I'd be much obliged. And I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.